have you seen me dice bag?
The Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dirk the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files podcast, where we talk bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day and today. I'm coming live from my den here in the heart of the northwest of England. I'm completely and utterly surrounded by my stuff. Here on my right is the great library of RPGs and my Grognard Files. So there's almost 10 years of it. Here on my left is the ridiculous homemade shrine to the actor Caroline Munro. I'll just give her a tap. Ah, the Eternal Champion has appeared as Margiana from The Golden Voyage of Sinbad. Yes, we must be back in the realms of fantasy. For Dungeon Crawl Classics, launched by Goodman Games in 2012, blending an old-school feel with modern chaos, emphasising random tables and innovative mechanics. It has evolved through editions and supplements, standing out with its gritty, unpredictable style and making every session distinctive. At the start of every module, it says, "Remember the good old days when adventures were underground, NPCs were there to be killed, and the finale of every dungeon was a dragon on the 20th level. Those days are back. Dungeon Crawl Classics doesn't waste your time with long-winded speeches, weird campaign settings, or NPCs who aren't meant to be killed. Each adventure is 100% good, solid dungeon crawl, with the monsters you know, the traps you fear, and the secret doors you know are there somewhere." Yes, in the room of role-playing rambling, I'm joined by our resident rules lawyer, Judge Blythe, who casts an eye over the rules and mechanical elements that make Dungeon Crawl Classics work. He's a fan. He's an acolyte of the DCC cult. Thanks to the High Priest of the UK contingent of the DCC movement and long-time member of the Grog Squad, Julian Haley, we managed to get a chat with Brendan LaSalle, a DCC GM at large, and the designer of X-Crawl Classics, a variant of DCC set in a future dystopia where dungeons are spectator sport. It's a great interview, you're going to enjoy it. Me and Blythe have had some closing time chatter with a confession from Blythe and me moping about my antediluvian complex, GMitis. I'm off GMing, but more of that later. I'll be back at the end, so ramblers, let's get rambling. Judge Blythe's rules! Welcome to the room of role-playing rambling. The light is blistering through the attic, and the little pigeon with the white eyes tapping on the window. Let me in, cuckoo, let me in, cuckoo. I've got Blythe with me. Hello, Blythe.
Hello, Judge. Mildly disturbing.
Mildly,
yeah. I'm used to it. I'm used to being behaved.
Cuckoo, let me in, cuckoo.
It's lived a long time, that pigeon, hasn't it?
It's been there for a long time.
So the pigeons live. How long do pigeons live? Relative to that woman of white eyes.
Might be a different one.
Yeah, that could be.
Might regenerate like a Time Lord.
Although the white eye disease is rife amongst the pigeons of Bolton, which wouldn't surprise me.
No.
Whatever that illness is.
Blythe, it has been a long time, just Blythe, since I've seen you in your full ermine.
Ermine.
With your
gaveling,
wig.
Gaveling hand.
Fingering away
at the gallum.
To pass judgment on yet another game. And this is a game that you play quite a lot, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I quite like this game.
Yeah, Dungeon Crawl Classic. Now, I need to say, my lord, that, as you know, there was a time when I turned my face against Dungeon Crawl Classics.
I think so, did I?
Yeah.
I think a few people have. That you speak to, I think one of the problems is it's quite a hefty old rule book and it's full of tables, isn't it? And I suppose you look at it, you can bounce off it a bit, I think. I certainly did, because you gave me a copy of the rules, a bound copy of the rules, and I remember having it and not really being able to, I remember looking at it and thinking, can I be bothered?
Yeah.
Be bothered with this.
People used to enthuse about it.
Mm.
And I think I explained once on this podcast that it was like white noise.
Yes.
People were speaking. Yeah, I wasn't. Yeah. They were speaking, but I wasn't being listening.
Yeah.
And I don't know why that is. And I don't know what it is about the game, whether it is the robot or whether it's the zealotry that people have.
Yeah, there is a bit of zealotry, isn't there? I mean, I'm a bit like that now. I'm a member of the cult now, aren't I? I know what you mean. There is that zealotry. People get very excited. And I suppose sometimes maybe our natural cynicism kicks in, where when people go, oh, this is really good, this is great, I play it all the time, I run it at conventions, all I want to play, you instinctively think, oh, come on, get out of it.
I think part of it is how people get overexcited about the death stamp.
Yeah, and they do, don't
it? It initially, when people talk about it, made me think of those kind of games that we didn't particularly like, where you had to roll a character. That time when you had to keep rolling characters, and everything was hazardous.
Harks back to the bad old days of, oh, another character's died, oh, another one's died.
And people taking delight in the death of characters.
Yes. Yeah.
What I've learned about it is that it's quite surprising. When I played Dungeon Crawl Classics and when I've looked at the rules, it is absolutely not what you expect, is it?
No, it's not really. And I think that death stamp thing maybe puts you off it a bit, because you think it's very much a Games Masters game. As if it's all, ha, 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 the evil Games Master's going to kill you all. Particularly with a funnel thing, which I'm sure we'll come on to talk about. There's that sense of, well, as a player, am I just at the mercy of a GM who's going to be quite malevolent and kill my characters all the time? Is that what I have to do as a player? I'm just going to there as cannon fodder. But I think when you play it, I would say it's probably one of the most player-friendly games I've ever played.
Yes.
Where actually, when you get around to playing it, it is all about creating a really good experience for the players.
Yes.
That's what's surprising about it when you actually get into it, I think.
Yeah. I made that point when speaking to Brendan, that it's a game that loves its players, because it gives you stuff to work with, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
And to create experiences.
Mm. But on the face of it, I know what you mean, there was that sense of, oh, it's loads of random tables, you're going to die a lot, and the GM's going to have great fun killing you. But what does that leave for me? And I think as well, one thing always stuck in my mind, when I got that rule book years ago that you lent me, I flipped through it, saw all the tables, because there's fumble tables, different fumble tables for different classes, different criticals for different types of monsters. There's all the spell tables, all loads of tables in it. A little voice in my head from years. Do you remember years ago, back in the 80s when we were kids, we read somewhere.
Yeah.
I think it was Simon who quoted this, or somebody quoted, you can always tell a bad game by the number of tables.
Yeah.
So the idea was, if there were loads of tables in a game, it was a bad game, because nobody wants to roll on tables all the time. And I think when I first encountered DCC, that was my instinctive reaction, was to think, oh God, I've got these tables. What's wrong with these people? Don't they know that putting loads of tables in a game is a bad thing? But I think what we've found out is quite a good thing.
It's quite a good thing, and it's not just DCC that's done that, is it? There's a number of games that have introduced tables and a random element to me.
And I suppose what was the thing with it is, what differentiates it from a bad game with tables is you're not always rolling on tables.
No.
Tables kick in at certain interesting points to make it interesting. I suspect the person who made that quote was perhaps alluding to games that you're rolling on tables all the time. So you're rolling on a table for every combat round, which, of course, you don't in DCC.
On the face of it, it seems like a very traditional game, like something that we would have played back in the 80s. But in other ways, it's like completely different from anything you'd play.
Yeah.
It's its own thing, isn't it?
It's
very much its own thing. You can't really categorise it, I wouldn't have thought.
Well, it's sort of, I suppose, if you had to describe it, you'd say, well, it's like D&D, because it's built on that. Is the word chassis, isn't it? Yeah. Chassis, the chassis. So it has that armor class, hit dice, hit points. It has all those familiar things. Roll a d20, beat their armor class, et cetera, et cetera. It has lots of other things in that feel very different.
But it's different from, for example, Blackjack or OSE.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Some of those games that go back to the original D&D and say, right, we're going to strip it all down and re-deliver it. It is its own thing. You can see remnants of D&D in it.
Yeah, yeah.
But it produces its own effects.
And that's an odd thing about it as well, because one of its marketing strategies is the idea that, because it says, I think all the modules and the rule books start with an opening paragraph that says something like, remember the days when dungeons were deadly and this, that and the other. So it sells itself on very much on a nostalgia thing, doesn't it? Dungeon classics.
Yeah.
And it has elements of traditional old school gaming here. So a lot of the adventures are very old school in that the concept behind is old school. Go in a dungeon, do this, do that, do the other. But you're right. On top of that, doesn't really feel like it fits in with that OSE, OSR thing.
No.
I know what you mean. It's like, it's not really a stripped back version of D&D. It's more like a kind of, it's D&D on steroids, isn't it? Right?
Yeah,
it's like a pumped up version of it, really.
Yeah, yeah. Perhaps if we get a chance, when we look at the Games Master screen, we'll look at some of those adventures, because I do think that that's what makes it stand out. In all the different versions of Dungeon Crawl Classics, it's the modules that are very distinctive and inventive, aren't they? They have a particular callback to Appendix N type things, and you might find yourself on the cover of a D&D manual, might you? It's so embedded within the world of gaming and weird fantasy that it can do that.
I always thought as well, when I first read the rules, it does have a feel of somebody, like it's been written by somebody who's taken D&D and house ruled it.
Yes.
In such a way to try and fix some of the problems that are in D&D. Whereas some of the old school games try and solve the problems by stripping back the complexity. So they look at Advanced Dungeons & Dragons and go, oh, this is a bit of a mess, isn't it? So what they do, they strip it back. And what Dungeon Crawl Classics did is it kind of took that and thought, well, do you know what? Instead of stripping it back, let's just add lots of extra house rules on that make it work.
Yeah.
It feels a bit like that.
Produces eccentric results, which we might come on to it. But are you a member of the cult, Lee?
I probably am, actually.
Yeah. Have you got a death stamp?
No, I've not got
You've not got a death stamp?
I've not got a death stamp. So that means maybe I'm an initiate, but I'm not quite a lay member. Lay member of the cult.
How many sets of the funnies? Dice and
three sets,
because the dice are different, aren't they?
You get a d5 and a d7 and a d14 and a d24 and a d30, I think, which are the extra pieces.
And is that out of awkwardness, or does that lend something to
it? Does lend something to the game, because it has the dice chain thing, doesn't it? So what it does, it occasionally you think this is just like, this is silly. This weapon is a D7 damage rather than a D8. Well, so what? Come on.
Yeah.
But I think the funny dice do two things, right? Two things. One, it does have some relevance in the game, because you get an action dice, and your action dice can go up and down. So your action dice to do things is a D20, but sometimes it can be bumped to a D24 or a D30, and sometimes it can be reduced to a D16 or a D14. If you get a penalty, rather than a penalty on the roll, you drop on the dice chain. So there is a mechanical reason for it. What's funny about the dice is, when I first started playing it, there's just a certain thrill about, we've all got used to the D8s, haven't we? I've got used to a D7.
No.
Rolling a D7 or a D24 was a bit like I used to feel when I was 12 rolling a D8. And I've played it with people who've never played it before, and I've said that, all right, But I you roll a D7. Oh, the D24. And they go, what? Say what? What? And you say, oh, a D24. D24? What's that? I've never encountered that. You go, oh, it's one of these. It recaptures the magic of rolling funny dice because we've all got used to it, haven't we?
Yes.
It's not that funny anymore, rolling a D20. D14 is like, oh, look, this is unusual.
But it is a way of getting you to sign up to the cult. So.
It is a way of getting sent to cult. Yeah.
Yeah. What about a T-shirt? Have you got a T-shirt?
Yeah.
You have got a T-shirt.
Two
T-shirts, right? Yeah. So there's hope for you yet because you haven't got it.
Could be saved.
Because you haven't got a death stamp.
I've not got a death stamp. But you know what? Only because I did try buying one, and the only ones I could find were quite expensive. But
right,
I think there are cheaper alternatives. You can get them made, can't you? You could just get someone to make you one, I think.
See, what I'm worried about you as a judge is your level of impartiality.
There isn't much.
There isn't much.
No, there isn't much. Let's be honest. I do like it as a game. So I'll be up front about that.
Right.
I like it.
Okay.
So I know I have to find something I don't like, don't I? The rules of the format.
Yeah.
We'll come on to that, maybe.
So to remind you, because it has been a while since we've done one of these segments, you need to pick three highlights and one duff thing to talk about. Right. And we always end up on the duff one because, you know, we always like to end on a negative.
Yeah.
Why, you know, defy convention.
Yeah.
So what's your first highlight?
I'm going to cheat a bit here. I'm going to say character classes.
Okay.
Even though within that, there are a few highlights, but I can justify my decision.
That's perfect. All right. The rules are here to be bent.
Of course they are. Yeah. There are rules.
There are rules. Not rules as written.
Yeah. Rules. Rulings, not rules. Yeah,
exactly. So character classes is your first one. Characters. What's your second one?
It's the spell tables.
Spell tables.
Spell tables and magic.
The third one.
I think it's the funnel. It has to be the funnel, doesn't it?
Funnel, which I was very sceptical.
As was I, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll come on to that. We'll talk about the duff bit in a bit. So let's come on to character classes. What is it about character classes?
I think what it's about character classes, what it does very, very, very well, is it makes all the character classes interesting.
Yes.
As you know, whenever I play a D&D style game, I always want to be a magic user. Because it's the most interesting character class, because you talked about this a lot, you can do stuff. And the others always seem a bit boring. So, you know I don't like clerics. They seem boring. Fighters seem boring. Thieves are all right, but, you know, can't do much.
So just remind me, what are the character classes?
It depends. The standard character classes are fighter, rogue, cleric, or priest, sometimes called a priest, but it's cleric, wizard, magic user. And members, elves, dwarves, and halflings. So it does the race as class thing, doesn't it?
Yeah. Okay.
And dwarves are essentially a bit like a fighter. Halflings are a bit like a thief. And elves are a bit like a fighter magic use. So they don't differ hugely from the four main character classes.
Right. So you're suggesting, I put to you, Judge Blythe, you're suggesting
I'm the judge after I'm being cross-examined now.
Yeah. That's it. I have to because your partiality.
No, I've not explained yet. I can explain you.
Yeah, but you've already made an assertion that it makes them all interesting. So you're suggesting that clerics are interesting in this game?
Yeah, I am. I am. Quite an achievement.
Okay. Yeah. So 10 years on, you were found.
In DCC, I'd say clerics are far more interesting, better developed.
So what makes them interesting in this game?
What I think makes them interesting is there is a rule. Each character class, so let's put wizards aside, because I think wizards are interesting anyway, and they use the spell tables, which we'll come on to. But let's talk about fighters, thieves, clerics.
Okay.
All got the problems, as far as I'm concerned, in a game, a D&D style game, right? So the fighter, one of the problems with the fighters is boring, right?
Yeah.
Because all you do in a standard D&D game, generally, is even if you've got a few special abilities, you hit things, you can soak up damage, you hit the monster hits you, and eventually one of you falls over. That's being a fighter. It's quite a dull thing being a fighter.
I think in early levels of something like 5th edition, it can be interesting.
It's a little bit more interesting.
Because you've got the feats, haven't you, that you
have. Yeah,
use.
You have, yeah.
But they soon
become insignificant
in the face of spells.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what DCC does, it has a thing called the Mighty Deed Dice. At every level, I think you start at D3, first level, then a D4, then a D2, then D5, 6, 7, so the dice chain thing. And what you can do is when you attack, you roll your Mighty Deed Dice and you add that number to your attack roll and you add it to your damage. So you could just use it to boost your damage, which isn't that interesting. But what you can do is you can do stunts with it. So as a fighter, you can kind of use your imagination a little bit and say anything from, well, I'm going to try and disarm them, I'm going to try and knock them over, trip them up, or anything through using your imagination about what environment you're in. It's a barren brawl, you're going to throw some beer in the face, or you're going to do knock them into the fireplace, all sorts of things you can do. And what you do, you roll your mighty attack, roll your mighty deed dice when you attack. And if the deed dice is three or more, you achieve the stunt.
Yeah.
So it gives fighters this kind of ability to be imaginative as a fighter. You be imaginative, can't you? And go, I'm in this environment. It's a fight in a tavern. It's a fight in a temple. It's a fight, whatever it is. I'm going to think about that environment and I'm going to try and do some stunts to make this fight more interesting.
And what it does is it makes fights spectacular, but not necessarily overly violent.
Yeah.
Now, what I mean by that is, I've talked recently on all of Rex's gaming vexes about fights and hit points and damage. And I do think in games, we've got like a novelty bias. So if you ask somebody, a player or DGM, to describe violence, and it becomes kind of anatomical quite quickly, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
You start having to describe how you've punctured a lung and you...
Yeah.
All the descriptions sound like critical tables, don't they? Because you've got this kind of... You never have like mal-chafing.
Graze knee.
But you're right, in DCC, you can have spectacular combat, but you can turn somebody upside down in a barrel, can't you? So the legs...
Yeah, that's it. Knock them into a barrel, they can't get out. Yeah. I'm going to do that. And I roll my deed die. We got a three. You've got to hit. So you've got to hit them. But if you hit them and the deed dice is a three or more, you've achieved your stunt.
Yeah.
I just think that's quite imaginative.
Yes. Yeah. And you get that swashbuckling feel of something that's exciting and thrilling, but not necessarily...
Because in those kind of games, you always get that problem of fights, from a fighter's perspective, are very, very mechanical in that you roll to hit. And when people start saying in a game of all skill essentials or something like that, oh, well, can I do this? Can I do that? It always becomes problematic because people go, oh, well, I don't know. Maybe you can. Maybe do me a dex roll. Although, is that too easy? Am I just making it too easy? Whereas in DCC, there is a mechanic for you that says,
I want to pick up the kobold and chuck him at the others.
Mighty deed dice,
Yeah.
So that's the fight has made interesting. Thieves are interesting because they use luck in a different way. So again, one of the problems in all these kind of D&D games, when you play a thief, one of the criticisms is always they're a bit crap. And when you have your moment where you want to hide in the shadows or climb a wall or pick a lock, you fail, right?
Yeah.
Or in DCC, thieves have a luck dice. So DCC uses a luck mechanic where you can spend points of luck to augment your roll. So if you've got your luck 10, you miss a roll by one, you can spend a point of luck to do it, that kind of thing. But what thieves do is when they spend a point of luck, they roll dice and add the dice. So I think a first level thief, it might be a D3 or a D4, then it goes up. So a fifth level thief might be a D8. And when you spend a point of luck, you roll the dice and add the total of the dice to your luck roll. So it means they're quite powerful in terms of being able to manipulate their abilities. So even when you fail that hiding shadows, you can spend luck. And instead of spending a point, you might roll a D6 and get 5 points of luck to add to the roll. So you can fail by quite a bit, and as a thief, succeed because you're a thief and you're supposed to be lucky and live on your wits. Played X-Crawl Classics with Brendan as GM at Expo, and I played a rogue and thief, halfling thief. It's the first time in all these years I've played a thief and really felt I was like, could be in the star of the game for a little bit, climb the wall, hide in the shadows, use me luck when I failed to achieve things.
Yeah.
You know, and it felt like the game, like we said earlier, it's on the side of the players.
Yeah.
You know, and I said to Brendan in the game at one point, I think I went exploring the dungeon on my own, climbing along the ceiling.
Yeah.
And when I failed, I did a few luck rolls and managed to do it. And I said to him, I'm sorry, I said, am I ruining this by scouting ahead like this and using my luck to keep going? And he went, no, he said, that's what you do. That's your job as a thief. That's what you should be doing.
Yeah.
That's the whole thing with that rule about the luck. And I thought, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is it, you know.
So you need, there's a bit of that is a permissive GM that allows that to happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
But also the rules.
The rules give you a chance to win. Because loads of times, isn't there, we've all played Thieves in D&D, and it's like, right, disarm the trap. Okay. 40% chance of disarming the trap. Oh, I've blown it. Okay. Right, try and pick that lock. Okay, Gary, right, 35% chance of picking it up. Oh, I can't pick the lock, sorry. It's like useless, aren't we? You can be useless, but with the luck mechanic in DCC, you could fail picking the lock by 5, and if your luck dice is a D8, roll a D8, get a 6, and go, there you go, done it. So it gives you that ability to use it. Doesn't mean you won't fail, but it gives you an edge in terms of doing what you should be doing as a thief, yes, rather than not doing it. You know, like, fail to pick the lock. All right, listen, you'll have to kick the door in. I can't pick lock. I thought you were good at picking lock. Well, I am normally, but I keep failing. I'll have to kick the door in again.
So the character classes?
Clerics. There again, clerics. One of the irritating things about the cleric is, I think, to be fair, some of the cleric spells in DCC are a bit better. They're a bit punchier and a bit more interesting, but put that aside for now. I think one of the things with the cleric is it has a disapproval rule. In games like that, D&D targets, where you play a cleric, everyone goes, oh, well, you know, you've got some spells and you've got your god, but just behave, otherwise your god could take your spells away. No, he won't. That never happens, does it? That's rubbish. But in DCC, when you cast a spell, you roll on a spell table. If you fail, your disapproval rating goes up. Every time you try and cast a spell, if the gods don't grant it, the gods are getting increasingly irritated with you for asking favours.
Yeah.
And then eventually, if your disapproval rating goes too high and you roll too low, you end up losing your abilities for a bit or be punished in some way by the gods. And I think that's good because you're a priest. What it does, it brings the whole idea that you are communing with some kind of higher being into the game on a constant basis, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I'm rolling to cast these spells. Every time I fail, I've not just failed, I've actually annoyed the gods for keep asking for favours, and that could backfire on me at some point.
It feels much more like a Stormbringer character as well.
It does,
because
it
dispenses with alignment. You've not got good and evil. You just got lawful and...
You got lawful, neutral and chaos. Yeah, again, they're not necessarily evil. Yeah, chaos isn't evil. It's just, and it's very clear about that, actually, isn't it? That, you know, a chaotic character is... You can be chaotic and bad. You can be lawful and bad. But, it doesn't necessarily follow that you're good or evil.
Yeah.
Just because you're one aligned.
Yeah. So it does feel very more cocky in that sense.
It does, and I think that's possibly, that's a good point, that, because maybe that's why the clerics in DCC appeal, because they do feel like agents of law and chaos.
Yes.
And I think at certain points they are described in that way. So it does feel like Moorcock and a Melnibonian kind of thing.
Yeah.
And maybe that's why it appeals more, because it possibly makes more sense. I don't know.
Yeah. Am I right in thinking that you could do things like getting an imp to come and intervene, can't you?
Have a patron. Yeah, you can have like patrons and things like that. And wizards can have patrons who can come and help you and, things like that.
But they can get annoyed about it, can't you?
Yeah. But I just think it does interesting things with all character classes. None of the character classes are boring. And I often think in games where you have character classes, there are always, I don't just mean D&D games, but where you get playbooks and archetypes, you always get a few archetypes that are a bit boring. You look at them and you think, I don't know what to play that for.
Yeah.
But I think DCC, they're all equally interesting.
Yeah. I agree with you. And I think it, the way that you presented it just reminds me that it is, I like it because it does one of those games, so one of those dungeon crawling games and fantasy games with enough, but not too much. So there's a lot going on, but not too much going on. Mm. So it's all, you can handle it. You can handle it as a player and as a GM.
Yeah.
It can send you into some crazy places, but it's not anything that you can't deal with.
Yeah, I'd agree. Yeah. It's not that complicated, but it still generates interesting. It might generate complicated situations, which are quite good fun, but the mechanics are not complicated.
Yeah. What's up next?
Spell tables. It's a kind of obvious choice. That's what it's kind of famous for, really, isn't it?
It is. But I find the element of it a bit unwieldy. When I've been, I think I mentioned when we talked about magic previously, so you need to convince me that this works. Because what I find is that it feels like a lot of bookkeeping as a wizard. Magic user, you've got to have your spell book. You've got to have a copy of the rules.
Yeah.
And some of the descriptions of the rules, some of the description of the spell, so the headline, may not actually describe what the effects are, because it will depend on how you roll, how that effect actually comes into play.
Yeah, I think, that's true. I would say it's the most complicated character class in that when you cast a spell. I mean, clerics are the same, but suppose it's just a little bit different with a cleric. The spells, when you cast a spell, there's a table, you roll a d20 and you add your level and you add your intelligence bonus or whatever, and it gives you a result. And if you roll a one, natural ones are like fumbles, bad things happen. And I think you get 12 or more, you get effects. And how high you roll gives you a better effect. So if you cast a fireball and you roll 12, it might just be a d6 damage. If you roll a 20, it might be 3d4d6. If you end up rolling a 26 or 27 because you've got extra bonuses, then you're going to get 10d6 damage, that kind of thing. So
it's not just mechanical though, is it? So the description of the effect actually accelerates, doesn't it?
Yes, it'll give you like quite a detailed description of what happens. And I think with some spells you can pick, but it's only ones where it specifies you can pick a lower effect, can't you?
Yeah.
But not all of them allow you to do that. So some of them, you might cast a spell and the effects are slightly more than you anticipated.
Yeah.
Whereas some of them will let you pick. I think that rope one you had,
yeah,
it does allow you to pick a lower effect. If you want something else, you can look at the lower effects and pick them instead.
And I think just to explain that rope spell, depending on where you landed on the table, it has a completely different manifestation of what it could do.
Yeah.
So if you're going into a situation wanting to climb somewhere, you may not necessarily get an effect.
No, but you could pick a lower effect that might allow you to climb.
Yeah.
I think some of the spells do that. Not all of them, but I think it specifies, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Pick a lower effect. And of course, the thing is, if you don't roll 12 or more, you lose the spell for the day. So if you roll good, you can keep a spell and keep going. But if you don't roll high enough, you can lose a spell. And there are, you can spend luck and there's a thing called spell burn, isn't there?
Spell burn is what it's famous for, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's when people talk about DCC.
Yeah.
Everybody has a story about spell burn.
Well, spell burn's always a thing. I always wonder whether if you were doing a one shot, you should outlaw spell burn. Because one of the things with the one shot is the wizard always saves all his points. It's a convention game. Basically, spell burn is you can sacrifice points of strength, agility, and constitution to add to your roll.
Yeah.
And you think, well, it's the final roll of the game. Just go wallop. I'm going to spend.
Put it all in.
8 strength, 8 agility, 8 constitution. Boom. I did that in my very first game of DCC.
But isn't that the point, though? That's why it's designed for one-shot play, that when it comes to the point, that's when you want your wizard to use its nuclear weapon.
Nuclear, which is what I think the first time I played DCC, I played the wizard and the spell burn. I thought, right at the end, I did that. I think I spent like 20 points of Spellburn, because I thought...
Didn't you burn a halter to then to the centre of the earth?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. But then again, I think you're right. That's the spirit of DCC, isn't it? Because I think what it tries to do, I suppose I can see why this is a part of the game that might not appeal to everybody.
Mm.
But I think, again, it's quite upfront about it. What it likes to do is create magic. It says magic is chaotic.
Yes.
So I suppose what it's doing, it's odd in that, you're right, the descriptions of each spell and what they do can be quite detailed and can be reminiscent of those AD&D spells that give you a, if this happens, then that, for two rounds, then this, then that, and you go, for God's sake. But I suppose where it differs is, it's almost saying, this magical thing you're messing with is quite dangerous and
volatile
and things can go wrong and stuff can happen that might not be a bad thing. And that's kind of exemplified in the mercurial magic rules, isn't it? So
yeah.
It has a table of mercurial magic where you, every time you get a spell, you roll on a table and it covers potential side effects.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's things like, when you cast the spell, your skin becomes transparent for 2 hours. Or there's one, I think, where you can change gender. Or one where rats will come out of your sleeve. A horde of rats appears coming out of your sleeves and your trousers when you cast a spell.
I think for my rope spell, I needed to have somebody else in assistance. I couldn't do it.
That's that Alankmar one where they have the stipulations where you have to have certain...
Yeah,
to cast them.
And I always found that quite appealing.
Yeah, it's kind of
fun. I had to, for example, pluck a piece of cotton off somebody.
Off the victim.
Yeah.
Yeah, to cast it, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's the funniest one, I think, on the mercurial magic, like if you roll a 1, you roll a D100, if you roll a 1, I'm sure it's 1 where it says, someone you know dies when you cast this spell. It's very funny. It's really funny. As you think, the player characters think,
you
cast that. How'd you work out who dies when you cast the spell?
Yeah.
But I think it's the spirit of the game, and I can see why some people might not like that.
Yeah.
And I think it's something where you can't really play DCC in its traditional format without accepting that the magic system is this kind of slightly crazy system. If you don't like that, it's probably not for you.
Yeah, but I think that's where the war stories come from. So when people come away from the table, it's usually because of some spectacular spell that is...
Yeah, some crazy side effect. Like there's one where every time you cast a spell, there's a 1% chance a demon appears and abducts you.
Yes.
So, you know, every time you cast it, you think eventually you might roll a 1 and be abducted.
Yeah.
There's some really good ones. There's one where you're transported to a different plane and you're replaced by a duplicate.
Yes.
Who's actually a different person. It's just so funny.
Yeah.
But I can see if you don't like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I suppose it reminds me in some ways a bit like paranoia. It's not like paranoia, but you know, like paranoia, where paranoia is a particular type of game, but if you don't like that kind of game, you won't like paranoia.
Yeah.
And DCC is like that. The magic system is the way it is. If you don't like that kind of thing, well, you won't like it.
Well, if you do like it,
you
become a zealot.
You'll love it and you become a cult member like me.
Yeah. Yeah. But without a death stamp.
Without a death stamp.
Yet.
Yet.
Okay. And the third thing is the funnel.
The third thing is the funnel, isn't it?
Yeah, this is the thing that created white noise in my head when people talked about
it. Well, I agree. I agree. I was the same. There was a bit, like I said earlier, I think it was the thing of, I don't like this idea. So I play like 4 or 5 characters and, they just cannon fodder. They just get killed, do they? All right. Oh, that's no fun for me, is it? They just get killed. Why would I care?
But so these are zero-level characters.
Yeah, you roll a zero-level character up. There's no character class. And they have a D4 hit points, plus any constitution bonus. So they could have 5 if they're really lucky. But yeah, and they like have an occupation, don't they? Like a farmer or a pig farmer or moneylender or whatever.
A gong farmer,
yeah. They might have a bit of a car. Like if they're a pig farmer, they might have a pig. A chicken farmer, they might have a chicken. Or chicken and a shovel. They don't even have weapons, do they? They have like, they might have a grave digger, might have a spade that does a D6 damage if it hits someone with it. That kind of thing. And the scenarios generally are things like you're a lord of villagers, you've got to go down a hole in the ground to save your village, so you're just ordinary people. Like I was reading, there's one I was reading recently where you were all press ganged into the army, so you're just all like ordinary people put in this situation, and you play an adventure out. There's a high risk a lot of them die, because they do. Whatever's left, you can then choose one to become a first level character. And often the adventures have bits in it where, and we've played a few like this, haven't we, where there are events and incidents and magic items and things that make you think, oh, this guy's found a magic sword and a magic shield and he's just slaughtered a monster. He's definitely fighter material, isn't he? Yes. That's what I'm going to make him a fighter.
Or if you get one that finds a book.
Yeah, then, yeah, that kind of thing.
Oh, well, they're going to be a magic user.
Yeah. And it's, I suppose what it is a lot of games have like life path creation things, don't they?
Yeah.
RuneQuest does, Traveller does. There's quite a few that do that. I suppose what DCC does is it plays out the life path thing, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So you play it out through a funnel, and by the end of it, if they're still alive, you then have a sense of, oh, well, they're going to become this or that.
And I've gone from hating the concept of it to loving it for that reason, because you are creating a backstory and because you're facing adversity, because you haven't got many hit points, and that you've got to use your intuition in these adventures to survive, you get close to them. And the fact that they've got a pig becomes very important.
It does. It does. When people get upset when the pig dies.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's true. I remember speaking to Pookie at Expo about that. And I think it was before I played. I think I'd played DCC. I think it was the first time I'd played it, but it wasn't a funnel. And I remember speaking to Pookie in the bar, and I said, I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. I said, I'm still not convinced by the funnel. I've not done a funnel. I said, I'm not sure about that. And he said that. He said, no, it's really good, because what you'll find is you'll get attached to these characters. Yeah. And even though they are a gravedigger with a shovel and one hit point, and the statistics are all rubbish, if they survive, you'll feel attached to them because they've survived, you know.
Yeah,
and that happened. I played it. A couple of friends of mine and his son played it. And at the end of the funnel, his son had two characters left. One was quite good. One's a bit rubbish. And he chose to play the rubbish one because he'd become more attached to him. He said he was like, the rubbish one had become the hero of the adventure. And he said, no, I'm going to keep playing this guy because he's great. I like him.
Yeah.
And I think we played the Dying Earth one. And Debbie's character was, I think, the only one who survived, and he had one hit point. Yeah. He'd had one hit point for the whole game.
Yeah.
So at the beginning of it, he was the one people thought, well, he's doing, isn't he, one hit.
Yeah.
But he'd managed to, he'd never been hit and managed to survive it. And there's a sense of like real kind of joy where you think, oh, great, you know, they survived, and so did his pig. Brilliant.
And because it's one of those games that generates stories at the table.
Yeah.
You carry that story into the next
game, of course you do,
don't you? When they become promoted to first level.
Yeah.
You know, remember that time when I went down with the villagers and I was the only one that came out.
The only one that came out alive.
Is everybody suspicious about it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Why did
the only one who survived after the others? Yeah. Clutching his magic sword covered in blood. You know, the villagers, what happened to them?
Yeah.
Came out clutching his magic sword and a pig. He was dead. Yeah. But I do think it's a great bit of the game, you know, once you get your head around it. Like we said, coming back to that, on the face of it, it just seems like some kind of kick for a GM to just kill everyone. Ha ha, you're all rubbish, you're all going to die. But they don't all die. And it is more player friendly than you imagine as a game.
Yeah. And as I mentioned with All Lands of Rexes, Gaming Rexes, you're talking about transferable mechanics.
Mm.
You feel like this is something that you could transfer into other games to have a set of under-resourced, low-level characters.
Yeah.
Put them into a situation.
Yeah.
From this, you'll pick the one that you want to take
forward. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So what's the thing? You've got to decide is the bun not?
It's difficult, really, isn't it? Because I like it. I don't know if that's come across. Has that come across that I quite like it?
It's come across, yeah.
I suppose, like you say, you could argue the magic system is a bum note if you don't like that kind of thing. I think that's, as I say, I think there's a little bit of a Marmite element to the magic system because of that chaos. It deliberately creates chaos, and it deliberately...
I'm going to suggest one, and it's related.
I have got one thing the spit doth, but it's a very minor thing.
Okay.
It can never quite work out how monsters do fumbles, because there's fumble tables in it, critical tables.
Yeah.
They've got critical tables for different types of monsters.
And that was going to be my suggestion, that the variant critical tables, you know how we said that there's enough yeah. without too much? Yeah. I think when it gets to critical tables, that's the point where it gets a bit yeah. too much, because it's a key moment.
Yeah.
And there's a bit of a delay while
yeah.
you work out,
yeah.
right, what's the next thing? Because I've got to look through these various critical tables
yeah.
to determine which one's relevant to this situation.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. And I think as well, I suppose there's a rule about armour and fumbles. So the heavier your armour, the worse your fumble would be. I suppose begs the question, is that really the case? Is that yeah. really the case? Just going to get heavy armour on, it's going to be worse?
I like the idea of yeah. monsters having different fumbles depending on the type of monster that they are and different criticals. I like the idea of different classes having yeah. access to different tables depending on what they've
yeah.
got or
yeah.
what level they're at. But in application, I just find it cumbersome. Cause
yeah, sometimes looking for that, yeah, fumble table.
When you've got X-Crawl Classics, like the game that we played at Expo, yeah. when it's moving at a pace yeah. and everything's pacing and it's a moment, let me just have a look here.
You can get.
Of course you can.
And I'm not saying I've got one, I've got two. You can get a little reference pamphlet with all the tables in, which makes it a lot quicker.
Yeah.
Obviously, when you've done your first blood sacrifice to the cult, get them for free.
So I've got to
get... You can make a donation to the temple and get a second one. Well, that does speed it up. The DCC reference book. It's like a little A5 pamphlet that just has all the tables in.
So what you're saying to me, in order to appreciate the game further, I need to become a full initiate.
Full initiate, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks for that, Blythe.
Introduced to the High Priest, to Vini Ailey.
Cheers, Blythe.
Goodbye. Open box.
Okay, welcome to the Zoom of role-playing rambling. To Open Box, the part of the show where we look backwards to look forwards. How our play in the past informs our play today. This time, I'm joined by games designer, sometime pawnbroker, and games master at large, Brendan LaSalle. Hello there, Brendan.
Hello, thank you so much for having me on.
Well, yeah. I've been looking forward to this.
You know, I don't get very many opportunities to talk about my former pawn shop career on podcast. So I'm just, you know, I'm happy to. Any questions you have, I'm ready to.
I'm looking forward. I've got a whole series of questions about that.
Outstanding.
Yeah. And where you were beaming in from, Brendan? Where do you live?
So I am beaming in from Kennesaw, Georgia, which is about an hour north of Atlanta, which is in the American. Southeast. We're the last stop you hit before you get to Florida, if you're heading south.
And have you always lived there? Is that where you were brought up?
No, it sure isn't. I was actually born in New York, and I lived, I grew up on Long Island. And then my family, we moved around a lot until my family settled in Georgia. And then I had one of those careers where I would leave and come back and leave and come back and leave and come back. So I've lived in Georgia, I don't know, 20 years non-consecutive, probably the longest I've ever lived anywhere in my life.
At the moment, Ben, you have to excuse me because it's really hot in the UK.
I'm watching
it. If I pass out, that's the reason why. Us Northern Europeans can't cope with the heat. You've recently been to the UK, haven't you? You've been GMing over here.
Yeah, I came over for the UK Games Expo. I've come over, you know, we all miss the lockdown years, but I think I've come over every year other than since... I guess 2018, I think that's right. Yeah, I love the Expo. It's such a fantastic show. I always have a wonderful time there.
I get the sense that you are always playing. Is that the case?
Like running games? Yeah, absolutely. When I come and do a convention, I really try to do as many events, as many games I can possibly, you know, cram in, you know, without, giving myself a, you know, make myself collapse or anything like that. Especially the expo where I only get over, you know what I mean? I don't get over to that part of the world very often. So I try to run absolutely as many games as I can.
Are you always on the move then? Is that part of?
Yeah, that's a big part of what I do for Goodman Games. Yeah, I do a lot of conventions, a lot of convention appearances, but I also do a lot of trade shows where we go and I spend a lot of my time running demos for real retailers and, working like that. I'm on the road a lot. I'm on the road a lot. Like, I think this year, I think I'm doing like 25 weekends, or weeks, depending on where I'm at.
My goodness.
I know, right?
Yeah. You're the Springsteen of GMs.
I'll tell everyone you see. I do, although, tell you what, as one of nature's dungeon masters / GMs, I definitely was born to run. So,
yeah. On your travels, do you see different play styles? Do people play differently in different locations?
That's interesting. No, I wouldn't say that there are like a regional play style. I would say there are some age related play styles. There's a way that there's a couple of the conventions that I do that skew particularly young, and you see a much, different play style. Although I wonder if we weren't to go back and look at ourselves at that age, it wouldn't be the same, wild and outlandish and absolutely, banking on the rule of cool to keep us alive,
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And just talk about your origins. So you came from New York. Is that where you started to play back in the day?
Yeah, I surely did. Well, actually, no, that's not true. I was living in New York, but in 1977, my family and I took a trip to California to visit with some friends of theirs who were on sabbatical over in California for a year. Their son, who was about my age, had just like started playing Dungeons and Dragons. So when I got there, he's like, "You got to play this game with me. You're going to love this." So it was an absolutely brilliant introduction to it, but it was also 2 7-year-olds trying to make sense out of the Blue Holmes edition rules. So, as you can imagine, we didn't go by the book very much. We had a fantastic time, and I walked away with the spell of that game, like, wrapped around my head. And, it was just, I got the bug. I got the bug at a very early age.
Yeah. And have you continued playing?
I've never gone more than about 6 months without playing, and I was looking for a group that whole time. You know what I mean? Like, it was never, I never took a big gap off from role playing. I changed systems many times, and had different phases where I did things. When I went off to college, I didn't have a lot of room in my stuff, so I brought the only game that took only one book, which was Villains and Vigilantes. So I pretty much, like, my freshman and sophomore year, that was the only thing I really ran at all, was V&V. So, it's interesting. There's a whole group of people who attended Loyola and whose first role-playing game was V&V with me. So, which is funny to think about. I've never taken much longer. I said 6 months maybe is the longest. And my sophomore year when, I didn't do too much then, but,
That's interesting to hear then. So I'm curious to understand how Villains and Vigilantes has informed your game style and how you play. Playing with superheroes is a particular genre, isn't it?
No one's ever asked me that before. That's so cool. So Villains and Vigilantes was actually the first game I ever GM'd. So when I was a kid, like I said, I learned out in California with my friend. When I came back, I discovered that there were kids in my Boy Scout troop who played D&D, so I played with them. And I was, one of the younger players, if not the youngest, at almost every table. So I was never a GM. I would show up with my character and I'd play. But I discovered, we went to a Waterloo Hobbies one day and we saw Villains and Vigilantes, and it was like, let me get this straight. There's a role-playing game where we can play superheroes. I was like, I was going to lose my mind. That was actually the first game I ever ran. So I taught myself enough of it to run. And looking back now, there were some things I didn't understand. That's why I just glossed over and did them like they did in Dungeons and Dragons. Kind of a lot of things, actually. But I'll tell you what, it really did make me think of the game as like infinitely customizable and very much a kit bashing kind of a thing. There are several rules and powers that you can get in Villains and Vigilantes that are like mutant power, where you can have a discussion with your GM of a power that you want an individual weird superpower that you would like your character to have. So, I remember somebody at my table had a bag that had infinite space inside. They could like pull pool cues out of and things like that. You know what I mean? Like that kind of thing. So I think I've always sort of like, I don't know, you know, I both think of ways to make existing systems very, like, really customize existing systems very hard. And I also, I don't know, I kind of like, you know, when you do superhero battles, they are gloriously unpredictable, with, you know, larger than life action. You know, people get punched over buildings and, you know, and, you know, turned in glass or whatever in the middle of the fight. So, so I definitely, I don't know, maybe that was the beginning of my kind of, love of the spectacular, set piece style of battle, which is definitely, part of my modern design, you know, style.
Yeah, definitely. And I also, I think with, those type of games, you had the level of competence that some, as a player, which you didn't necessarily get. And I think some of the OSR stuff kind of leans into the thing that, you know, you might be dead at the roll of a dice, but
yeah,
you
know, yeah,
having competent characters, you've got a chance to play the game, haven't you?
Very true. Yeah, very true. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, I, you know, certainly killed my share of OSR characters, you know? So the Villains of Vigilantes was really like, it really didn't get killed very much in V&V, but you definitely had to be on your toes because you never knew what you were up against. You know, there was no, you know, going around the corner, oh, here's a troll. We know to use fire or acid. Instead, it's like, oh, here's a guy in a helmet with a cape. What can he do? You know, so.
Yeah. So our podcast has been about rediscovering vintage games in our, you know, middle-aged years. And I've always resisted Dungeon Crawl Classics, but everybody said I'd love it. And for some reason, and I don't know what I put it down to, I think it's because if people are into DCC, they're zealots for it, aren't they? They get converted and want you to play. So I think me being a contrarian instantly starts to turn against it.
Just that, you know. No, I get it. I get it.
But and the other thing is that people say it's OSR, but having played it now, it's not OSR at all, is it? It's its own thing, isn't it?
It is, yeah. We get lumped in with OSR games because we definitely have an old school look and feel and sensibility. But the true OSR games all go back to one version of Dungeons & Dragons and do a version of that rule set cleaned up and house ruled and changed up, you know. It's usually very specific. DCC has way too many novel rules and systems for it to truly be considered OSR. I mean, we have old school art. We definitely have an old school aesthetic. But if you had to put a label on Dungeon Crawl Classics, I always say it's weird fantasy.
There'll be people who are listening to this who haven't played, so give the pitch for DCC and what makes it distinctive.
I feel like Dungeon Crawl Classics creates much more of a roller coaster experience at the table. It's higher highs and lower lows, like, throughout. We love crits and we love fumbles. We love the chaos of the game, so we have several systems that will allow you to do unpredictable things at the table. You've got, like, mighty deed of arms that will allow you to really use your, you know, rather than just, I make an attack, I do some hit points damage, you know, you might be like, all right, I'm going to go in and I'll try to stab this monster through the foot so he can't run off. I'll try to, you know, cut one of his ears off, or, you know, like, in, you know, systems to kind of, like, allow that to happen. Magic is very chaotic in Dungeon Crawl Classics. So the part of the DCC ethos is that, you know, magic is this uncontrollable force that, like, mortals can learn to wield it, but never to actually master it. It's unmasterable by its very nature. So we have a die roll that goes along with casting spells, and you can cast a spell that has an average amount of power. You can fail, you can fumble a spell and lose control of the energies and, you know, have a misfire or gain a corruption that your wizard then has forever. But we also have the ability to roll, like, to you know, roll high, do well, and go above and beyond and have these the absolutely game-changing spell results that you couldn't have predicted, but, you know, if it hadn't come up on the dice. You know, I feel like it's the Dungeon Crawl Classics, I think, better than any fantasy system I've played. Dungeon Crawl Classics makes, you know, is the system most likely to have you walk away from the table with an amazing story of, you know, what happened that you just can't wait to share with other gamers. Something really unique. You know, it's just built into the DNA of the games and the rule setting that there's just going to be unpredictability is always going to be a part of it. You know, there's no monster that's out of reach. There's no player that's out of reach, no matter what level they hit. You know, there's always, you know, is, you know, you just you can't guess at what's necessarily going to happen. It's the most unpredictable game system I've ever played that doesn't feel just like a grab bag of chaos.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because I think it's a game that loves its players, isn't it? And I think that's why people do feel a kind of zealotry for it, because when you've played it, you've had an experience.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you can't wait to meet the guy and go, oh my gosh, our wizard botched a spell and we all shrunk down to 6 inches and we had to finish the dungeon, you know, the size of action figures. You know what I mean? Like, that's happened. I've heard that story, you know? It is amazing like that. I also think that part of the thing about DCC is, and this is just from doing it for a long time, my theory is that Dungeon Crawl Classics, the rule set, it self-selects for the best players. You know, I think about the character funnel, you know, and so if you're not familiar with Dungeon Crawl Classics, we begin the game with a character funnel. So if we were going to sit down to a new game, you and I wouldn't just create a bunch of new first level characters who would already have skills and talents and abilities, but albeit at a low level. We would each create 3 or 4 zero level characters, just, you know, peasants and, you know, people who aren't particularly competent adventurers, and then we would each run all of those characters through a character funnel adventure, which would have, you know, a horrific style adventure that would just have huge casualties. And whoever survived out of that would become your character. You know, I've seen again and again, if you talk to a room of gamers and you say, "Hey, I've got this, wacky game I want to play with you guys, but we're going to make a bunch of zero-level characters who really can't do much of anything, and you're going to go up against monsters and demigods and possibly go to other planes. It's going to be a meat grinder. But whoever lives, they're going to level up, and you'll have this random cool character that has this crazy experience." You know, the kind of player who is like, "Oh my gosh, that sounds amazing. I can't wait to do that." You know what I mean? Those are people who are really down to have fun at the table and who are just going to allow the game to be the game. And that's very liberating as a GM and as a player, I think, just to sort of like, you know, give yourself over to the wildness and have fun with it.
Yeah, I definitely think that funnel does that, because, as I say, I entered into my first game as a bit of a skeptic, and it was the funnel that actually did it for me, because what you're actually seeing is you're creating a backstory, aren't you? And
oh, yeah.
Even if you're trying to stop yourself, you fall in love with the 4 characters that you've got, and they've all got characters, and there's like an emergent story and an emergent. Once you get to that first level, you feel like you know these characters.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and they've been through the trenches together. They've done something absolutely amazing, you know, which I love.
Yeah, it's good to see it at the table. I mean, I have got a question about, you know, how much delight do you take in using a death stamp? That's one of the listeners asked.
I love it. I love getting a picture of the table afterwards with all of these character sheets with like 3 or 4 stamps on them each. Like, that's just like, that was a day. You know what I mean? You know, like a whole lot of red on the table. That's a good day right there, you know?
The other thing that strikes me about DCC is the inventiveness of the scenarios, the adventures that have been produced for it. And it really lends from Appendix N, and it's like self-referential, and there's a few callbacks to jokes within The Hobbit.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know? Oh, it's the best. You know, I've designed for Pathfinder, I've designed for Dungeons and Dragons and for Call of Cthulhu, and DCC is absolutely the most fun system to design in, you know? I mean, one of the, you know, key principles of it is that monsters just break the rules. You know, they don't advance and do things at the same level as the characters. They have their own different set of abilities. So you can be, you can kind of infuse your monsters with a lot of personality and a lot of unique things without thinking, well, how does this fit into one of the extant monster templates? You know what I mean? You know, that from a design standpoint, that makes it fantastic. And then the designing a funnel, like designing a funnel is an addiction. You know what I mean? You know, like when you set up a bunch of characters and you're like, all right, I need a monster. You know what I mean? Like, you know, to a zero level character, you know, a dire wolf may as well be, you know, Owlbear or, you know, Godzilla, for God's sakes, because it's just, you know what I mean? That's your chances. So it lets you sort of throw a lot of design principles out to the window. So you can have zero level adventures where your characters meet demons or dragons or go to other planes of existences, you know, throw them in situations that they're absolutely not ready for yet. And then, you know, just watch them have to get clever and lucky and brave in order to get through it. That's a compelling story to me that I want to watch again and again and again. And high level design is just the same. You know, you really can, you know, the world that is created by the parameters of the rule system is really interesting to me. One where magic is always wild, where gods get angry with their clerics and they, you know, are dealing with them directly and will, you know, punish them for things that the clerics themselves don't even understand, because you're dealing with these, you know, infinite beings who exist on an entirely different plane than yourselves. You know, I love that. From a design standpoint, it never stops being a lot of fun.
And you can get it in different flavors. And we have been playing a campaign of in Lankmarthes.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah. The way that you pitched it, it sounds like it's meant for like one-shot play and, you know, conventions really suit it. But also, what we found with Lankmar is that there's lots of elements to build a campaign, isn't there? So there's a lot of downtime activity that you can build up as well.
Absolutely, yeah. Lankmar especially, but frankly, I feel the same way about regular dungeon crawl classics as well. You know, I run multiple long campaigns that are a lot of fun. They get weird. You know, I mean, they get much weirder than your average D&D campaign, and you can't, you know, by the end of it, everyone's a mutant. Everyone's owes a god a favor, has an enemy of a patron or something like that. You know what I mean? They, you know, people have had these, you know, experiences and found these items that have just changed them forever. But, you know, I think it does short style play particularly well because of the nature of the rules. You know, you have a much better chance of having a really interesting arc over a 4-hour convention, session, say, for example, you know. But I think campaign play, I mean, I've run, like I said, I've run multiple. We have the Blades Against Bandwidth campaign we ran for our streaming show. You can watch all that on YouTube with my old bad microphone. Sorry, folks. But like, that's a great, I mean, as far as the campaign goes, that was really interesting. They went to some places, you know, I think it's very good for short term play. And, you know, it's the kind of thing where you can have these brilliant outcomes that feel like the end of a novel at a 4-hour session.
Yeah. And some of the scenarios for Lankmar are really, as I said, really inventive, really good ideas within the game. Good. And as I said, there's different settings. We've also played in Dying Earth.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So that's been good. So how important is it? Because Goodman Games has really let into the Appendix N.
Yes.
It doesn't. Yeah.
That is a big part of our aesthetic, is going through, taking the best bits of what is there to glean from all of the Appendix N works and authors, and then, you know, running it through our own personal strange filters and creating cool adventures out of that. You know, I feel like the Lankmar books were what D&D looked like to me. So to me, DCC feels more like I always hoped Dungeons and Dragons would as a player. You know what I mean? It feels more like, you know, actually running, actually playing through these worlds that were created by Appendix N authors.
Yeah. And I think it really helps you to lean into the idea of Lankmar being a den of iniquity, you know, and weirdness and strangeness. And it really, the rule set really helps to support that. I mean, you could even have a pawn brokerage, couldn't you, in Lankmar?
It would be the most common thing in the world. One of the things about Lankmar is that it, in my mind, it can feel like a real crime city, you know, and you'll have these weird moments. I got to run one of my very favorites not too long ago, Acting Up in Lankmar. And my players are like, they're outside of this theater. They're like, I'm going to look around and see if there's any criminals that are out here, people watching us or anything like that. And he rolled a natural one on his check. And I said, oh yeah, there's a guy over there at the corner of this theater. He looks real shifty. And the guy walks up and he's like, hey, so what are you doing here? And the guy's like, all right. And he opens up his coat and he has all of these, he's a scalper. He has all of these tickets to the theater that night. He's like, I got mezzanine, I got balcony, I got this. And it was like, this is the kind of thing it would never occur to me to do in a standard fantasy thing. But like, absolutely there would be ticket scalpers, like just working it in Lankmar, you know, when you have that level, like the haves and the have nots, oh man, the have nots would be doing anything they could to get a little bit of that have money, you know?
And talk about a universe with the haves and have nots. Let's talk about X-Crawl and X-Crawl Ooh. Classic. I got a game with our mutual friend Jules Haley at X-Crawl.
Jules!
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Hello, Jules. Hello, Sue.
And, yeah, it was a crazy game, but it really introduced the setting for us. So just, again, just give us a pitch for X-Crawl.
Sure. So X-Crawl is as if your standard fantasy world has grown up, evolved, and become our modern media-saturated world. It's definitely a two-tiered society, and now the wealthy and the elite have created a contest called X-Crawl, which is recreating the dungeon experiences of old by having DJs, dungeon judges, make artificial dungeons in arena settings that teams of adventurers go through as a competitive death sport. So it's got all of the elements that you would expect from a regular dungeon, you know, crawl. You've got to deal with monsters and traps and treasures and find secret doors and clues and puzzles and riddles and all that. But it's all kind of has a flavor of like a lethal game show. And you're, you know, part of it is working the crowd and becoming famous and, you know, crossing over and, you know, getting your face on a cereal box or whatever it happens to be, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really good at creating that sense because you get a sense of the world beyond the spectacle through sponsorship deals that you'd strike up. So I think we were some winter clothes manufacturers. I can't remember the name of them, but yeah.
Oh, nice.
I'll probably lose some points for not knowing the name of our sponsor.
You should be wearing them right now, like in front of the, you know. Yeah, a big part of X-Crawl is like, you know, working those sponsorships, you know, and it's always been fascinating to me to think of like, you know, when a death fort first arrived on the scene, everyone would be like shying away from it. But eventually someone's like, look, if we put, if we put them in our t-shirts, our sales are going to go up 1,000% over the next month or so. So, you know, the idea that this is a contest where the athletes can absolutely and do absolutely die night after night. And yet still we're going to use it to sell car insurance and washing powder and whatnot. So
yeah,
pretty grim.
And what it allows is a dungeon without necessarily any logic. So yeah. Each room is like a setup of no get out of that, isn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely is. You know, in the, you know, the old days, there was a lot of stress on dungeon ecology, the ecology of the dungeon. And how does this thing live here? Where does it eat? You know, and, you know, DCC or X-Crawl is really based on my playstyle. And, you know, that's the first thing I love to abandon is that kind of thing. You know what I mean? And so when you come across a bunch of laser penguins who are all on scooters in a room, why are they there? Some producer thought it would be a good idea. He pitched it. They made it work on paper. They did some rehearsals. It worked. And now you got to fight laser penguins, you know, or whatever it happens to be, you know? So, So, I mean, that's a big part of it where you can create as a designer, you can create these kind of like grand strategic challenges that you would never, would make no sense to encounter in the real, you know, any kind of a dungeon setting, you know? One of the earliest X-Crawl dungeons, it has got a water elemental that's just full of piranha. You know, which I just could, you know what I mean? Like, I was like, well, of course you would do that. You know what I mean? If you could, you know, how do we spice this elemental up? It's very boring. You know what I'm saying? So,
yeah. And I didn't realize, Brendan, that it's got a bit of a storied history, hasn't it? X-Crawl. I thought, it has been in previous versions, hasn't it?
Yeah. Yes, it absolutely has. So, the first iteration of X-Crawl, which was X-Crawl Adventures in the Extreme Dungeon Crawl League, came out through Pandahead Games in 2002. And then once they got out of the D20 publishing business, eventually it got, after a few years of me just, you know, driving, you know, going around every convention where I could and playing as many games in front of as many people as I could, eventually it moved on and got licensed by Goodman Games. Then there was a, the original version was for the 3.0 Dungeons and Dragons rules. And then the second published version was for Pathfinder. That came out, that was Maximum X-Crawl, which I think came out in 2014. And the latest iteration is, of course, for the Dungeon Crawl Classics rules. And it's, frankly, the best one by a mile, by 2 miles.
And what I think it does very well is it acts as a satire, doesn't it, of American life. So that's kind of bold.
I hope so. Yeah. American life, celebrity culture, you know, sports culture, and definitely capitalism. You know what I mean? And, and what it's like to live in an actual two-tiered society with this gulf between the haves and the have-nots. Yeah. It definitely, you know, it comes from a place of satire, definitely. But like, to me, it's, you know, it's always both a satire, but it's also like a very serious dungeon challenge where you had better. You know what I mean? You can't just go in there, I'm going to have some fun and make some jokes. It's like, you'll get eaten. You know what I mean? Like, you all got to come correct as a crawler, you know? So,
yeah. That's very true, isn't it? Because you could see this as a bit of a comedy game, but I didn't have that sense when I was playing. I felt like the players had to step up and think ingeniously about what to do. And there were comic moments that emerged from it, but it wasn't necessarily full on.
Yeah, exactly. That's really what I wanted to go for, where it's like the setting is both is absolutely absurd in a lot of ways. The idea that this world exists, that they spend so much money and resources and things to create these horrific challenges, and that, you know, and that, yeah, that that sponsors paid to have these monster killing, you know, adventurers who more often than not die in the arena, you know, go out there and, you know, wear their patches and try to, you know, advertise their product. You know, I mean, it is hopefully at the same time, it is both absurd and a very deadly, deadly serious dungeon experience.
Yeah. Because I was surprised that it had such a long history, because I felt like it was tapping into the zeitgeist, you know, the idea of, because they're doing a remake of The Running Man, aren't they? And, the Squid Game and all those things that have become very popular. But it was way before that, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, 2002. I think I'm even pre-Battle Royale, if I'm correct. You know what, I just missed Battle Royale, which was 2000, but I hadn't seen it, I swear to God. No, the big influences for me, there was the book The Running Man, and then the movie The Running Man too, but also there was a couple of specific episodes. There's that one episode of Star Trek, Bread and Circuses, where they have to fight on the televised, you know, arena. That's a direct thing. The video game Smash TV was a direct influence. You know, the idea of these guys are running around and, you know, smashing up other people and, like, you know, winning microwave bonuses, like, you know, the absurdity of that. The Gladiators show, which, you know, we had, you know, you had Gladiators, we had American Gladiators. That was a huge primary influence. You know, I've told the story before where I saw that on, I saw advertisement for that, and I was so excited about American Gladiators. I was like, you know, I never made time for TV, but I was like glued to my set, that thing. And after 10 minutes, I realized this was just like a for fun sporting competition that looked like a gladiator. Like, no one was really going to get beaten up. I really, you know, in my, you know, childish brain, I thought, oh, we're going to see some. It wasn't even like that. So I had to make my own.
Yeah. And it's definitely a play style, isn't it? Because it does lend itself to the spectacular and those V&V adventures that you.
Oh, yeah.
He has.
All set pieces, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And we're about to run a mass participation game, a season of gladiator combats, you know, like a Roman gladiator. What do you think it is about that kind of setting that lends itself to role-playing games?
Well, I think that combat as a performance is always going to be a really interesting thing that you can mine, you know? But, you know, from a lot of things, like especially lethal combat, you know? I mean, boxing is one thing. I can see you can have a career as a pro boxer and all this, you know? But like, if you're, you know, like a career as an X-crawler, you're there having to perform for people who are going to cheer just as loudly if you live or die, you know? And what that does to you psychologically, I think, is a really interesting thing to explore, you know, what that means to an individual character, you know? And also, again, the gladiator, you know, the arena thing gives it the same kind of lack of constraint for the ecology that the X-Crawl thing does, which is, you know, they put you in the arena. Today you're fighting gladiators. Tomorrow might be lions. Next day we might flood the whole place and put boats in there. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. The idea that the point isn't death, the point is spectacle. And that gives you a lot of leeway to create interesting structures inside of each individual room where, you know, it's not just about, I got to get past these guards and get over here and steal this thing. It's like, I got a showboat. I got to make it look good. I got to go through this thing that is designed to make me look good or bad, depending on how I play it, you know? To me, that's a very interesting, you know, again, mode of play. And I think speaks a lot directly or indirectly to the psychology of the participants and the viewers, frankly, you know? I mean, you know, world with a death board, a world of gladiator combat. That's horrendous to think about, you know?
Yeah.
But also, what would it be like? I mean, you know, if we lived in that world, I would be terrified all the time for all of the athletes I cared about, but I would tune in. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I recently watched the Spartacus series again on DVD. Don't judge me. It's quite a lot of nudity in that, but yeah. So, and what that plays into is the idea of that there's a lot of political maneuverings of the people in the balcony watching it. I think that's an interesting dimension to it as well.
Like through like gambling and whatnot, or?
Yeah, gambling and using gladiators as getting positions of influence within the Senate and
war by proxy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's cool. All that element of it as well, isn't there? That's
oh yeah. I think X-Crawl can have a bit of that. You know, I think that especially in a game where people become like, you know, think about how actual celebrities skew things. You know, if the right celebrity backs the right cause, that cause is going to get pushed through whatever, you know what I mean? You know, if it's at the right time, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I could definitely see, you know, your high level, very famous, well-heeled X-Crawl participants, you know, so all of a sudden it's like they put their bag, you know, behind literacy or, you know, whatever it happens to be, you know, wetlands preservation, you know, people are going to queue right up and help them out. So it can definitely, that kind of influence can allow you to be very political. I definitely see it.
Obviously, you're continuing to design for X-Crawl. What direction is it going to go into next?
Well, you know, I really want to, okay, I'll tell you my goal for it, okay? My goal for it would be to create a kind of like a worldwide organized play for it that would actually play like the games themselves, where you would have, you know, GMs running teams through things with real specific rules parameters and equipment parameters. You know, I'd love to see like the big board up there someplace, you know, in brackets and everyone like, you know, working their way down from the bottom of the top, you know, but at the same time, I have a campaign, you know, so like you said before, there have been several iterations. Since the very beginning, there's always been a stage two to the world of X-Crawl that I've never been able to get to because I had to start all over from scratch again, you know, it's still out there and I still want to tell that story, you know, and who knows? So maybe at some point I can like, I'd like to do create a kind of a event that would be a kind of draw a line like that was old X-Crawl world, old X-World. This is new X-World. And who knows? Maybe I'll get the opportunity to do that in the coming years.
Thanks, Brendan, for spending this time with us. It's been really good.
You're very welcome.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me on. And everybody, you know, who's listening, thank you very much. And, you know, come check us out at goodman-games.com and see what all coolness we have in store for you.
I'll get me caught.
We're wandering towards the door. I think that pigeon's flown off now.
Mm.
And we've still got our coats on. We're not going to feel the benefit, even though it's like blistering heat out there. And we're just finishing off with our closing time chapter. What is your closing time chapter?
Closing time chapter is confession. I have a confession.
Yeah, okay.
Confession. But I'd still blame you. Blame you for all these things. I did finally buy Dragon Bane.
Yeah, you say finally buy.
I bought it. And you know what? It's really good. So
you say finally, but we the last podcast when we were talking about how it would be impossible, you said, for me to fit Dragon Bane into my repertoire.
Yeah.
So don't...
repertoire? Did I say repertoire? I don't think I said repertoire.
No.
That's a very you word. Not a me word. You have a repertoire. I don't have a repertoire.
I'm trying to fit the word antediluvian.
Right, okay.
Because I heard Miranda Hyde use it in The Rest Is Entertainment, talking about Timothy Chalamet or something like that. But, you know, so you've added it to your repertoire. It's in your arsenal. It's on your shelf.
It's on my shelf.
And what's more, you're playing it.
I played it and I've run it. Yeah, it's really good, isn't it?
It is good. I knew you'd like it.
I know, it is a really good game, isn't it? It's kind of really well designed. It has like echoes of old school gaming, but mixed with new school stuff. It's very slick, very well written rule book as well, I think. Yeah. So I played the Sinking Tower on the Raspberry Raven, the tournament module, which I'm running at by the time this goes out, I might already run it, hopefully. And I've run a little bit as well for you, haven't I? And a little bit for the Good Friends of Jackson Elias convention. Weekend with the Good Friends of Jackson. I ran some there. So I've run quite a bit of it because I got quite excited about it. It is a nice game, very nice game.
Yeah.
So yeah, I've got it. It's in my repertoire now.
Yeah, and can we look forward to some campaign play?
I'd like to. It'd be good to, wouldn't it? You know.
Yeah.
I mean, I still stand by it, that frustration that I got it, I like it, but there is a slight frustration that you think, God, I'd like to run more of it, but when? There's always that problem, isn't there?
Yeah.
But then again, I suppose I have to concede that your point, well, you might as well get it, even if you don't run it immediately. You've got it, haven't you? So
yeah. You've not to see these things as a bucket to be emptied. It's a river to swim along.
Okay.
And you pick these things and when you're ready for them.
When you're ready for them.
And when they're ready for you.
Yes.
Look at DCC.
Yeah, it's true. It's true, isn't it? It was hanging around in the background for a long, long time, wasn't it? And then, suddenly you kind of tune into it, think, oh, this is very good.
Yeah, it's what I need right now. My closing time check. I want to finish on a downer, but I'm still in the throes of GMitis.
GMitis, yeah. It's very unlike you, this.
Yeah.
More my kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not in the space to run games.
Yeah.
Help me, blithe. What is this? What's it down to?
I don't know. It's always difficult to resolve, isn't it? I've been there, but I think it is just the old adage, shouldn't you get up back on the horse? It's the only way you can really do it.
Yeah.
And hope that when you do, I suppose I've always been lucky that when I've had a bit of GMitis, I've got back on the horse and the games I've run have been okay. And I've thought, oh, it's okay. That was just a bit of a blip. It's all right. I sometimes worry if I got back on the horse and fell off again immediately. What point would I think, oh, no?
Yeah. And the way that it's manifesting is... I'm really enjoying playing them. I'm in a number of different games and I'm probably playing more now than I ever done.
Yeah.
Maybe that's it, that some of the space that was occupied when I would probably be doing some, I don't want to call it preparation, but sometimes just getting my brain round, right, what am I running next? It's been taken up by playing. That might account for some of it. Some of it is because I've been doing different things and doing other things. But I mean, I'm finding that I'm not getting the same pleasure out of running games. And I just don't have the motivation to put myself forward. Because you're going mad for it, to use an Oasis term.
Mad for it.
And yeah, you put anything that comes up at the moment, you're signing up for.
I've run quite a bit, I'm running quite a bit at the moment, I suppose, though, that does come from buying Dragon Bane, and I bought Mythic Bastion Land at Expo as well, didn't I? And I suppose I took the view, well, I've got these games, let's try and get them run. Let's run some. Let's put some forward and run it now rather than let it sit on my shelf. I suppose the opposite to what you've just said about being in the river, I've decided to empty the bucket. Is that right? And empty the river. It's their metaphors. Yeah, so I suppose I've done that.
I don't know whether I just accept that. I'll just have a break for a bit. But you know, I'm going to, the counterintuitive thing of not jumping back into the game account, to have a break for a bit and then get back into it in September when it's over.
I think as well, it sometimes is about good and bad experiences. I recently had some quite good, positive GMing experience. So a game at Expo around was good. The game I ran for Good Friends, the Good Friends convention, the Dragon Paint game was good. I enjoyed running it, you know. And I think you enjoy running things. You think, oh, this is okay. I like this. I'll do some more. But if you, it's not necessarily a bad game, is it? I think if it's just a game you're uncertain of or something that you don't think runs quite as well as you thought, it can leave you feeling a little bit deflated and a little bit, you know.
Yeah, that's what's happened to me. I've run a couple of games where I thought, not that it went badly necessarily.
No.
But it's that effort to pleasure ratio. I thought it required a lot of doing to do this. And yet when I've finished it out, I ended up feeling a bit dissatisfied.
Yeah, I think when you run games they go one of three ways. So they'll either run like you imagined and you think, all right, that ran how I imagined it would run. And you never imagine it going badly because you think, well, I wouldn't be running it if I thought it would be rubbish. So that's that. Or they surprise you and go better than you thought. So, you know, they're a bit above par where you think, well, that's I thought that'd be okay, but it was actually really good. Or you get the third option, which is it's not as good as you think. It's not bad. It's not a disaster. But it's just not quite as good. It's not quite as good as I thought it would be. Didn't run quite as well as I thought it would run, and it leaves you feeling a bit. And I've been there. I've had games where we won't name names, but the odd convention game where I've come away thinking, that was a hard one. I'm glad that's over.
Yeah,
but it then leaves you with that problem of why am I doing this? Why was I doing that for 4 hours? I'm glad it's over.
Yeah,
you know, was it me? You know.
Yeah.
Hmm.
No, I'm sure I'll get through it. I've experienced it before and got to the other side.
Yeah, I think everyone does. I think everyone has those moments where, because it relies on so much, doesn't it? It's a social hobby. It relies on people. It relies on people understanding the scenario, people getting into it, enjoying it. Sometimes if you feel people are not quite tuned in or whatever, it just sometimes leaves you feeling a bit nonplussed, I suppose.
Yeah. Well,
it's shaded us all up, hasn't it?
I didn't even manage to get antediluvian into the sentence.
Well, you mentioned the second time you mentioned it.
Yeah, but it's not
context. Not the same. It's just,
no, it's not the same.
You mean in context?
In context.
Yeah.
I'm never going to get that gig as a Guardian columnist, am I?
No.
See you by then.
There you go.
There isn't another bit. Thanks to Brendan. It was really good talking to him and feeling his enthusiasm for the game. Go on. You want to have a go at X-Craw Classics? It's really good fun, spectacular, and creates humour around the table and encourages players to be really creative. At the time of releasing this, it's actually DCC Day, a day where Goodman Games give people a chance to learn their games, the 19th of July 2025. I'll put a link in the show notes. I will keep this a short one, just to say thanks to you for listening, and the patrons who chip in a tip in the jar every month to keep this show on the road. I've recently released another exclusive podcast for patrons, Dirk's Dossier, where we talk a bit more about our gladiator plans, and I mope on about my GMitis. There's going to be a second part to this episode released next month, but we're going to slip in an extra in between, as on the 7th of August 2025, it will mark 10 years in your ear with this Bobbins. But until then, adios, amigos.